and welcome to Spoiler Alert. I'm Blake Kelly. I am your host for this week. We have a jam-packed, exciting, fantastic episode full of adamantium and optic blasts. Our panel today, as going around, first and foremost, Brandon Hyde. What's up?
Hey.
How's it going, Brandon?
That's pretty good.
Fantastic. Oh, by the way, we're recording this on a Monday, so I'm going to talk about Monday a lot. I'm sorry. Happy Monday. We have Mark Diefendurfer. What's up?
Hello. Yep, this is Mark.
And last but not least, our very, very, very special guest, our good friend, Daniel Pratt. We passionately call him Crane. Crane, what's up?
Ain't shit, man.
Perfect. And we're going to kick this off with what you bought, what you thought for this week, guys. And by this week, I mean last week. The big release was, of course, Detective Comics. And because I'm hosting, I'm going to take the reins and begin right away talking about Detective Comics 881, Scott Snyder's last issue of Detective Comics before the relaunch. And that was some quacktastic stuff, guys. That was a kick in the face. Scott Snyder, who, based off everything that I have seen, is being positioned to take over the creative reins, so to speak, of the Batman universe. I know Morrison probably would never say, I have creative control. He's the one who decides how the status quo is going to continue. And I believe that they're positioning Scott Snyder to do it. And I think it is a brilliant decision. As much as I didn't hate Tony Daniel and his work on Batman, and of course when the relaunch happens, Detective, Snyder has proven to be the most capable of telling excellent Batman stories. It was very good. Let's go around the room. I know, Mark, you haven't read Detective Comics 881, right?
Correct.
So we'll start with Brandon. You just read it, so I am excited for your take right out of the box. It was good, wasn't it?
I really loved it. That's like probably one of the best stories I've read of Batman. Like, I've read a ton of Batman stories, all the like from the Morrison stuff to the all the grim and gritty detective stuff, but this is by far one of the best. How he handles every character in his entire run is just like is a masterpiece. Like, how he writes Commissioner Gordon is beyond anything. It's just he understands him so well. His voice is right on. It's like if Frank Miller, it's almost the exact same way he writes him in Year One. And I think this is like one of my favorite runs on Batman. And Snyder's, he's amazing. I'm really excited to see what he's gonna do next.
Crane, what'd you think? Did you read it?
Yeah, I did. I really enjoyed it. It was good enough that I went back and had to release this entire arc. And I haven't been on the Snyder and Jock train like a lot of people have, just because I've been trying to keep my books low. But after reading this one, it was very often in comic books, it's hard for people to get to really understand the pace and the suspense of writing a thriller. And what he did there, he made a new villain for the first time in years in Batman, a new villain that actually was a threat, and not a threat even in a physical sense. I mean, in a fist fight, there's no way Batman wouldn't wipe the floor with him. But he had him on the ropes mentally, which you don't see often. And usually it's, and then not in a way that the Riddler just makes some weird little joke and there's a bomb going off somewhere. Like, he got into the minds of not just Batman, but Commissioner Gordon and Barbara. I mean, everybody. It was fine writing all the way through. I was I wasn't expecting to read what I read there. It's making me want to go back and see what else Snyder has done with Batman, because I'm really excited whatever he has in the future.
We're lucky because I believe the Black Mirror hardcover is about to come out, and that's kind of the perfect opportunity to start collecting it. I'm going to want to keep it forever. His run with Detective Comics. I mean, and so I'm going to pick it up, and it gives me a great chance to start rereading it. You're only as good as your villain, and I think this is something that one of the disadvantages to Morrison was that sometimes his villains kind of fell flat. At the end, though, I think the Black Glove turned out to be a very strong villain, so it helped out Morrison as it continued. But James Gordon Jr. is genius because he's extremely intelligent. And he's capable. Like, for example, he figured out that Dick Grayson was playing the role of Batman.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, I think everyone agrees that James Gordon Sr., Commissioner Gordon, is aware, but kind of doesn't really mention anything for the sake of kind of keeping things going. There's no point in him saying, haha, I know you're Bruce Wayne. He's not a moron, okay? He's too good of a detective, he knows. James Gordon Jr. has shown he is also capable of as a detective. This issue, of course, has him cornering Barbara Gordon, the former and future Batgirl, and the current Oracle. And there's this, and the part is, he's got it there, and they're kind of going through this psychological chess match. And Barbara has shown herself to be more than capable of, like, counterpunching James Jr. if anything that he has to throw at her. And he throws off the blanket over her legs, and there you see that he's stabbed both of her legs that she's lost feeling in. And so she's beginning to, and once he removes them, she's going to start bleeding to death. When the preview that came out the week before, you saw the part where he was about to throw open the blanket. And to be honest, I was kind of expecting the tease where she could now walk and she was going to kick him in the face. But the way they did it was just like, you take him so seriously because you know he means business. At the beginning of the arc, you see him and Dick, they meet together, they're talking, and then, of course, James Gordon goes into the house of the gentleman who they were referring, oh, remember so-and-so. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. And you see that... Huh?
It was Ben Wolf.
Thank you, Ben Wolf. And you see James Jr. going to the house and taking his mail out of the mailbox, heading down, and there you see this slab of a man hanging there with his tongue sticking out, bleeding profusely. Like, what's going on? And then it shows the scene from the panel behind him, the full page, and there you see his jaw on the ground, and both of his arms, and both of his legs, and James Gordon Jr. coming in and saying, all right, let's finish this, let's continue. And it's just this villain that means business. That villain was fantastic.
I think what's interesting about the villain, how Snyder wrote him, is that, like, there's two things I think is really fascinating, is that he wrote a new villain that's for Dick. It's not for Bruce, because, like, with Bruce, he's had enough of his own special villains. Like, if you look at Hush, it's a villain from his past that makes sense. But if you look at the new villain, Junior, he... you know, he's Dick's villain. He's not Bruce's. Like, he's special to Dick because he grew up with him. He knew him as a kid. Mm-hmm. So it's a completely, and it works out so well because one of his themes is that, like, in Gotham, it's always changing. It's becoming a new entity on its own. And I think that kind of, it's a great comment on, like, the villain is that, like, he's a completely different monster than anything, like, he's that Gotham has seen before. And he's like, and they're both evolving, like the villains, and the criminals, and the city are evolving at the same time.
Right. Well, I mean, you look at it, a lot of the villains that are Bruce's, the Joker, Two-Face, the Penguin, they're more. It's almost like an opposing sports team's best player. It's for the Dodgers, it's Barry Bonds. You see him and you're kind of like, ah, interesting. But it's no one really that he's like, nothing that he would call his own, so to speak. It's like you're kind of going into this really never feeling like, okay, well, this is his villain. And now he kind of understands what's going through Bruce's mind. What James Jr. is essentially is Dick Grayson's Two-Face. Because Harvey Dent was a close friend to specifically Batman, and based off the animated series, was friends with Bruce Wayne. The comic continuity goes back and forth on that. And then, of course, Harvey Dent turns into Two-Face. And there you see a close personal villain to Bruce. James Gordon Jr. is now Dick Grayson's Two-Face. And someone he knows personally that has just... I guess the difference is with Two-Face, he has multiple personalities, and you feel like he can be saved. What you see with James Jr. is that's who he really is. Like, he is now, like, if you want to really be specific, the insanity was him not killing. And what was sane to him is when somebody calls him out, him doing something crazy like he did all through this entire series. It's just kind of like he was always denying who he felt he really was, and then it kind of, like, sprung, and it blossomed into this just haunting villain, the Snyder crazy mind.
Yeah. Just an interesting thought I thought of is I'm really excited for Snyder's new series, Severed, which is primarily a horror series. And I think that's definitely going to be a strong suit for him, considering there's a few moments in his run on Detective that were... were terrifying. There's a few pages that were just actually kind of surprised me by how just scary they went, like, so quickly too. And Jock is, like, he's, I was really surprised or really impressed by, like, everything he did. He does an amazing action, and then the very small, quiet scenes are just amazing. He's a fantastic artist.
Yeah, I'm not the biggest Jock fan ever, but he, I'm a big fan of his covers. He draws an awesome Batman in a silhouette situation.
Yeah.
But he kind of won me over with how this art was going. Dan, Mark, anything you guys want to add?
I was going to ask, what company is Severed coming out of? Is that Vertigo or Image?
I'm pretty sure it's, I think it's Image, but I'll check the last week shipping thread.
All right, Crane, anything you want to add?
Doing another book, another creator-owned book, I mean.
Oh, just what I said before about it's pretty much all my thoughts on the book. It's, I guess I should have known what a name, like, spoiler alert, we go into that territory, but yeah, it doesn't, I really want to go into too much detail in that regard. It's just, it's a great book. People should read it. More people, I know a lot of people are going to read it. It's Batman, but more people should. And just reckon, I'm looking forward to whatever Scott Snyder has coming with the new DCU.
I'm very critical of people who don't like Grant Morrison's writing, mostly because of the it's confusing. I do understand more of the people who kind of who prefer a more grounded interpretation of the Batman. For all of you guys that are a fan of that, specifically read everything he did with Detective, starting with the hardcover, The Black Mirror, that's about to come out, which Black Mirror is pretty intense in of itself. And he's going to take over the Batman main book starting in September. With Bruce Wayne at the helm. So you guys are going to get to see a more grounded Batman, and a grounded Batman I have no reason to believe it's not going to be excellent. And it's going to be, I'm excited, because it's going to be a different read, because we've been reading Dick Grayson is a very, very different Batman from Bruce Wayne. Snyder made a point of showing that. It'll be great to see what he can do with Bruce in the role. I'm pumped for Batman starting in September. We're just a couple weeks away from it. Anything else for Detective Comics, gentlemen?
Well, actually, after, since you brought up that point, I'm actually one of the people, I mean, I like Grant Morrison's run on Batman, but I'm more of a fan of the more grounded, isn't the word for it exactly, but I like Batman as more of a noir story. There's some, you know, he deals with supernatural, but some of the stuff that Morrison has on Batman sometimes gets a little, for lack of better words, flowery. He throws in some villains, even dealing with the Black Hand. Black Glove, I'm sorry. Other than the Black Glove himself, other than Thomas Hurt, I mean, who are the rest of those villains? And he does that a lot. He'll add a bunch of side villains, and I'm supposed to care or whatever it is about them, but it's just a lot of, it's like a lot of noise goes on there. But while here, you see it's a very well-developed villain, sinister, feels like a Batman villain. Dr. Hurt just seems... He seems like this, if you like that silly style of Batman villain, then he works there for you. I wasn't a big fan of him, but I will say that I did, I mean, I like Morrison's run up to a point. I liked it coming from a company of heroes? What was the heroes thing? The Club of Heroes.
Mm-hmm.
From that on, I liked it, but I did not like the first two arcs of Morrison's run, not in the least bit, to be quite honest.
Right.
But I did like, I mean, hell, Club of Heroes was a very, if you think about it, it's close to a very traditional Batman, so it's not too metaphysical.
I love Club of Heroes so much. That J.H. Williams art.
And then, hell, Batman R.I.P., that story, I felt like it did not work until the second to last issue or so. I mean, it was six issues. I think it was the fourth or fifth. Before I said, okay, now it all makes sense. Before, it just felt like a lot of stuff was happening.
Mm-hmm.
I needed that thing to be tied up. So I definitely get why people would be turned off by what Morrison does if you like a more serious take on your Batman. So it's that's why I'm really interested in what Snyder's doing, because it's more along the lines of what I like to see Batman doing. Not to say that Morrison's stuff was bad. I just prefer this type of Batman.
Now, how did you feel about Professor Pig? I know that there's some villains Morrison, like the Flamingo. Who's a pretty, like, like colorful villain like that. But Professor Pig is colorful, but I took very legitimately. Like I'm excited to see him in future stories. Like
he's a silly villain in the same regards of like a Mad Hatter or something. So he worked well enough, but there's not enough to him before I could say he's a classic villain or anything. He needs some time to him. There's not a lot of depth to Professor Pig other than being he speaks in basically nursery rhymes and he wears a pig mask and he puts masks on people. He's not all that deep of a character. I mean, it's hard for me to say anything. Even Morrison hasn't fleshed him out that much yet. I mean,
we know how he comes from, and we know how he ends up because he was in the first page of Batman 666. He's the one who was crucified upside down.
Yeah.
But I mean, whatever's going on with Batman Inc. with Leviathan seems far more interesting to me than anything he did with all the Batman and Robin stuff. The villains he's had in Batman and Robin so far, none of them were all that interesting compared to what it seems like he's building to in Batman Inc.
Don't you worry, Crane. I'll be talking about my Leviathan theories outside of the podcast.
please keep your theories away from...
All right, gentlemen, let's dive head first into something else. That's Detective. Oh, Brandon has more. Hit it.
Actually, one side. I just wanted to do, but before we stop off, just one more thing about Snyder. As Mark was asking, it's about the new series by Snyder's Severed, and it's by Image, and it takes place in 1906 in America. And it's basically an ongoing horror series. There isn't much said about the synopsis. Just is that there's pretty much a man that haunts the road, a man with sharp teeth and a hunger for flesh. And the main character seems to be a 12-year-old Jack Gurren. So it's pretty interesting. I'm really curious.
All right. Yeah, could be good.
Snyder got a question at Comic-Con. Like, what do you like to have, like, these such twisted ways of killing people in these books? And he's like, I'm just a regular old family man who writes comics. So I think in unique ways. And kills fictional people on the page brutally. Again, there's, like, the arc before the last one... with a new villain called, I think, the Killer Whale, or the something like the, yeah, this whale centric villain that he creates.
Mean Tiger Shark?
Tiger Shark, that's it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Tiger Shark is new, it's been around for a while.
Oh, it has? Wonderful. Well,
I think Tiger Shark has.
Yeah, he's been around since like
the I know there's the White Shark, who was the main villain of Face to Face.
Well, the White Shark is pretty new. Dan Slott created him. But yeah. When you say Killer Whale, I thought you were either talking about Tobias Will or you're talking about Orca, but Orca's dead. So it's an Orca with a woman. So it's Tiger Shark. I swear that character's existed for quite a while.
It rings a bell. I mean, it kind of sounds like an X-Men villain, but anyway. I guess
he's like an old Green Lantern villain, isn't he?
Well, this guy is a gang lord, so he doesn't have any powers. Well, he has. I mean, he looks to be blind, but anyway.
Yeah, he's an old Batman villain. He may have repurposed him. I don't know if he's existed since the original, like early on in the book. So this may be a new take on an old character.
Okay, fantastic. All right, well, let's go into the next thing, guys. And I think this might come as a shock to you. Buckle up. The Ultimate Spider-Man is dead. Ultimate Peter Parker's dead. I know.
Okay.
It leaves everyone. And we have a new Ultimate Spider-Man. And the character's name escapes me. What is his name?
Miles Morales.
Miles Morales. He is half Hispanic, half African. Am I correct by that?
African-American,
thank you. African-American and Hispanic. And he is the new Ultimate Spider-Man. The origin of his powers has not been revealed yet. We just kind of, we have an introduction to him, but the news really isn't what happened in the, what was it, Ultimate Fallout 4 when he was revealed?
Yes.
Yeah, the news so much isn't with, like, what happened in the book itself, but more about Miles Morales himself and the fact that there is this character of ethnicity, of two ethnicities right there, boom, in Ultimate Spider-Man, and I kind of wanted to open the floor a little bit to that. It's been disappointing for me to see, the reactions from a lot of forums with the news of who the new Ultimate Spider-Man is. It's got a great costume. And B, the kind of back padding that Marvel has been doing with this kind of like, look at how big we are, look at what we did. it kind of makes me like, I wish we were, the day that race isn't news is when it goes away. And I would have preferred, right. I think that this was, I mean, it's great. It's terrific. But what do you guys feel about it?
I guess I'll go first. What most people, and none of you guys know me, so I'll tell you, I am an African American. Mm-hmm. But it's, I figure I should get out the way for some things I'm going to say here, but I'm okay with that. I mean, I don't like how their way of switching to a minority character in most comics is, let's take a character that's already known and then make them black or something like that, instead of making a Luke Cage or a Black Panther, you know, a character that's themselves. They're not taking this, they're not standing in for a white character. I prefer that. But even so, we don't know the circumstance behind it, and that's fine. The reality of the situation is when you make a change like this, no matter who's in, if it's a new person, it's going to get marketing. But if you make it a new something with a, they change the race like that, there's definitely a marketing standpoint for it, but they can't be quiet about it. There's going to be back padding. I appreciate them for trying. I don't like, it feels disingenuous, but it comes with the territory. Anytime that a character changes race like this, it happens. I just hope that they stick to their guns and they don't end up killing them later. The worst thing they seem to do all the time is switch to the minority thing. The character might actually catch on, and then they end up killing him later or replacing him and bringing back the original guy. I was like, well, what was the whole point of all this? They did it with the Atom, and it sounds like in a new DCU they're actually switching back to Ryan Choi, which mm-hmm. I really hope they do, because Ray Palmer, there's nothing interesting about him at all. But I mean, this happens so often that it's not news to me, because it's just that common. I just hope that in the book, especially with Bendis writing, and I don't know what experience he has with writing minority characters other than Luke Cage, really. So I'm just hoping that he doesn't make it his stance to talk about the Black or Hispanic experience from a Jewish white man's perspective. Like that always rings a little bit hollow, especially when it reads more stereotypical instead of true. And I hope that he can bear line of writing a true, strong character and not writing a black character, but writing a good character. I really hope he does that. So, I mean, I can't judge it till they actually do it. The marketing side of it is gross, but that's just, it's the way of the world and it's the way of our country. So I've seen it enough that I'm used to it. I just hope that he does well by the character.
Brandon, Mark?
I also wonder if it was a great idea for them to have him be like a black character from the ghetto. Like, he couldn't have been like a black young man from like an affluent family or, you know, something like that. It just feels like that was a chance to, you know, kind of break some stereotypes there. And then kinda...
only reason I'm not too messed up by that is that even Peter Parker, technically, I mean, he was broke too. So it's not like they're going from Tony Stark to a broke black, a broke Hispanic dude. Like they're going from a struggling young white kid who's struggling to make ends meet to a black kid who seems like he's struggling to make ends meet. But again, we haven't really seen a lot about him to know anything about his circumstances or what he's doing in life. So it's unfair to judge that part of it. At this point, all we know is what we're seeing in Fallout 4 and just pictures from covers. That's all they've really shown us so far.
And really, what's the motivation for young, happy man, minimum wage, but kind of like a middle ground, good family, both your parents, a brother and a sister, let's say it's a white male. I mean, what motivation does someone have to go out there and be a superhero? I mean, Clark Kent's motivation was the fact that him and both his mom and pa believed he had great power and he was brought here on this earth to do this. I mean, there's your exception of a middle grade family that their son becomes a superhero, but what motivation really does an everyday guy have to be a hero?
Well, Iron Fist, I mean, he's rich and he still does it.
This is true. This is true. And I mean, Tony Stark's motivations are what happened to him. But anyway, Brandon, you want to add anything to it?
I think it might be, as you're saying, like what really motivates someone to do as you said, like be here. It might be something they might like carry off from the Peter Parker. Maybe Miles, like he watched Peter Parker die, and he somehow, I don't know, they haven't revealed how he got his powers. Maybe he's inspired by his death to do this, and as an honor to him, and wants to take up the mantle of Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an interesting way to do it, but I don't really know about the character so far. I know that his introduction was, like, for me when I was reading it, it just read a little bit awkward how he talked and how, like, I know that his introduction is supposed to be very rough and this is his first time gonna doing something, so he's not used to it as much as like Peter would be. But I couldn't really get into it, and I'm not really excited for the relaunch now.
Wow.
Here's kind of my fear, with them making this like so much about the racial aspect in the news. And don't get me wrong, I'm fine with anybody being Spider-Man. It doesn't matter. But them making it so much about the racial thing is that, you know, say Ultimate Spider-Man continues to not sell well, and a few years down the road it gets canceled, then Marvel can say, well, you know, we tried this whole minority character thing and didn't sell, so, you know, we can't have minority characters now, or you know what I mean, though.
Right.
Yeah.
It's and they didn't help themselves by, you know, starting this character out in like the fourth issue of a book that wasn't selling, you know, like huge numbers.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just worry about it from that perspective.
Well, it's easy to put Ultimate Spider-Man. I mean, the Ultimate Universe is on its way out. I mean, let's be honest. Who here in this podcast thinks in 5 years will there be an Ultimate Universe?
Well, I mean, it might be still plodding around, you know. But I mean, it's kind of just been, it's felt like it's been on its last legs for years now.
You know, true.
Maybe 3 or 4 years, and they've stripped it down to like 3 ongoing series or so.
Mm-hmm.
One of which doesn't even ever come out, the Ultimate X.
I mean, it's easy to make Ultimate Spider-Man and make a massive change like this. I mean, I think it would. I mean, you want to show courage. Of course, then again, there is probably a half Hispanic African American Spider-Man with the Spider Island crossover. So there's probably a Miles Morales Spider-Man going on in the regular universe.
Go ahead.
Sorry. Oh, so this is technically the second Hispanic Spider-Man. I mean, that long running book going in the 90s with Spider-Man 2099 with Miguel O'Hara. He was Hispanic and he was Spider-Man. The thing is, like, this isn't the first time it's happened. And that book sold well and sold for a while. It's just the 2099 line ended.
Because I feel it's easy, I think when I look at something like DC and what they have done with Batwing, who is the Batman of Africa. Now, I know Africa is really, really big, but that's a new character with his own rogues gallery. When you start seeing Bruce Wayne show up, then you're going to know the book's in trouble, because you got to throw in the Batman crossover to get some extra sales. But it looks like they're going to try and establish him in that giant country or continent. But that all said, I mean, I think that's something to be taking your hat off for, maybe a little bit more than... Ultimate Spider-Man has now, this character who has been white for the last 12 years is now going to, we're going to change it up. Look at us, the line's down. It's so brave.
Yeah. Batwing to me seems just as disingenuous as this Ultimate Spider-Man thing. Is if you have a problem with that one, I mean, just by the basis of how they're marketing it, saying it's the Batman of Africa, it's the Batman of, like, it's, I mean, let's get be real. Africa is a continent.
Mm-hmm.
It's a large space. It's the, what is it, the, is the largest continent on the...
Well, Asia is probably the largest.
Second largest, then. Yeah, it's the second largest continent. I mean, it's a lot of space, but you don't see that. You don't see. Let's look at the other Batman. There's a Batman of England. There's a Batman of Spain. There's a Batman of Mexico. There's a Batman, of course, of the U.S. There's a Batman. There's a Batman of France, and there's a Batman of China and Japan. There's all these different Batman of Italy. I mean, there's all these different Batman in the different parts of these other continents. But then Africa, again, the second largest landmass in the world. Second largest continent, and you say that this one Batman can handle all that because, really, it's to us for you know first world is here in the West. We view Africa as being one like just a country, this one big place. Like Ghana, Sudan, Ivory Coast, Djibouti, and South Africa. They're different cultures, different places. Kenya. Nigeria, these are all different countries within a large space. So this one Batman is covering this entire place, correct? I mean, it's almost insulting to say he's protecting Africa. All right, then take all the Batman out of Europe and have Knight and Squire cover all of Europe, and then put one Batman down in China to cover Japan and Laos and Vietnam and Korea, just because apparently only one Batman needed for one continent. It sounds like white guys who don't know any better just saying because it sounds good on paper. Like, yeah, look at our worldview. Look how multinational we are. Like, you don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. It's ignorance is driving it here. Like, if you were working a little bit better, you know, there's more problems than one person can take care of. And it bothers me because it seems like the only reason they haven't pat themselves on the back about it is because it doesn't mean anything. It's an extra character. It's just like, yeah, Black Panther. Anything he does doesn't make news other than the Black Panther and Storm wedding making some news because Marvel made it news.
Yeah, and Storm's an X-Man. So.
Yeah, Storm's the reason why that was popular. I mean, it's Black Panther, anything he does in Wakanda wasn't a big thing. But then you have this, but you know, it's even, but I'll give it to Marvel. They never say, oh, he's the superhero of Africa. He's the superhero of Wakanda, a country in Africa. And it's, I don't know. It always, since his first time he was revealed, it rubbed me the wrong way because it just seemed just misinformed.
Wow. That's very well said, Craig. That's Brandon, Mark, anything you guys want to add to it?
No, I haven't read the stuff about this the Batwing series, but maybe once we get to it, it'll turn out that he's, you know, from a specific country. I have no idea. But yeah, if they're marketing right now as like this is the Batman of Africa, then that is kind of dumb. Yeah.
Brandon?
I got nothing.
Got nothing? All right. There we are, race and comics and comic creators. If anything, we have learned with this Spider-Man news that there are a lot of really racist comic fans. There was a lot of people angry about this stuff, and I did, please, come on. And anyway, we'll go from there. All right. Any other comics you guys want to talk about? What you bought? What you thought?
I have a few. At least I want to quickly touch on because you know we want to hit these other things. But definitely want to mention Punisher Max. I'm a big fan of Punisher, and since Aaron and Dylan have taken over, it's been a very very good look into the character of Frank Castle, and it's just a great, there's nothing I can say other than it's a very good read, and you should really get to it. It's Dylan drawing like Dylan does, so if you don't like that, then it's not for you, I guess, but Aaron is, for some reason, he's cued in on Frank Castle's mind in a way that only Ennis seemed to be able to do in the last decade, and it's a very worthy follow-up to the original Max run. Also, want to point out War of the Green Lanterns. It's an okay book that's setting up a lot of stuff in the future. But again, it's okay. That is an all right ass book right there. Fear Itself. Don't read it.
Fear Itself. What was it? Four that came out last? Was it four or five?
Five. Fear Itself is going this many issues with nothing happening. It actually does some real Jedi magic where it tricks you into believing that something's actually happening when you're reading it. But when you really, really, if you write down what happened in the issue, nothing really takes place.
I told you that it did. I told the listeners today was Monday, and today, like, the first wave of preview solicits came out, and you see, like, the new Avengers lineup, and you don't see Thor, and they want you to really believe Thor is going to die or leave or something's going to happen to Thor. They're trying really hard to believe it. I don't know if I believe that. And it's just the book goes through this stuff to make you feel like things are serious. Spider-Man wants to go spend time with his family. This is going to be serious. Captain America's shield gets shattered. This is a serious threat. I read it and I was like, okay, all right. Then again, I'm a fan of Flashpoint, and I don't know how I would defend Flashpoint to someone who might have the same arguments.
Oh, Flashpoint's the same. It's the same thing.
If
you write it down, nothing's happening.
But anyway, the fear itself.
And the one last thing I wanted to touch on was, and it's a book that I only know one other person that reads this, but I'm going to mention it anyway. Uh-oh. Crossed, Psychopath.
Oh no,
I've read the original Crossed. So
yeah, me too.
Oh, if you read any of let's say Ennis is the restrained one, because David Layton writes, he's from Family Values to Psychopath. These are some of Psychopath number three, this the issue before this last one, had one of the worst things I've ever seen in a comic book.
The scene in the cave? So I heard about that.
The scene with what?
It was a scene in the cave.
It's in a basement. But it's seriously the worst thing I've ever read in a comic. It's like, and I don't mean worse like, oh, this is reads terrible. I mean, one of the most horrible things I've ever seen happen in a comic book happens in that book. And I don't know why I keep reading Cross. But I keep, for some reason, I'm oddly addicted to this Cross story and this cross world, which is all horrible. I mean, there's nothing redeeming about any of it. Artistically, it's not fine or anything, but Latham, like, something is wrong with it, dude. Because this is his second book, and if you could ever say that Ennis is the one that is tame compared to your book, I mean, that never happens. And it's, I wouldn't recommend, if you're faint of heart, don't read these books, but there's a little something under there, a weird inspection of a insane human mind that may be worse than the Cross that are, you know, killing people throughout the rest of the series. But it's, I'll tell you right now, if you have a weak stomach, dude, just don't even try reading it. Don't even look. Yeah. If you think the covers are too much, then don't read the book.
The funny thing is, you didn't say anything that happens in it, but the fact that you mentioned Crossed now makes this podcast explicit. Like, this podcast is now rated explicit because Crossed was just mentioned. Any other books, guys? I got one more thing I'm going to talk about. It's not a comic.
I'm good.
Brandon?
I want to talk about Secret Six, because the last issue came out recently, and it was awesome. Like, that was one of my favorite issues of the whole series.
Go on.
I don't know. I didn't want to spoil too much, but I want to talk about Simone and how she writes Bane is probably one of my favorite things, like, ever. It's just like, throughout the whole series, that she's wrote Bane to be like, he's trying to be good now. He's trying to redeem himself. You know, he was bad before. He broke the back of Batman. Now he's trying to save everyone, but it was kind of near. It's the second to last arc. They go to hell, and they pretty much find out that, like, yeah, you're gonna end up here. It doesn't really matter what you do. It's inevitable that you're all gonna end up here and just be tortured for the rest of your life. So then he just decides, he's like, screw it. There's no way I'm, like, ever gonna get to heaven. So he just decides that he's just gonna kill Batman now. And that last issue was awesome. It sets up so much stuff for the new relaunch. But I really hope they keep the continuity with Bane, because it's gonna be really interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, I don't know how I missed that. That was a very good. I don't know how I missed that. That was a very strong issue. The ending of it alone would make me kind of sad that they're rebooting things, because that's, like, if that doesn't get carried over, there's a big loss for DC, because Simone has set up something very amazing to happen.
I'm dead. That sounds really cool. More Bane is always a good thing. I like Bane. I don't hate Bane. Bane's been poorly written, but I think that character has a lot of potential.
He was written really well this entire series, and I think there's like he probably had one of the strongest moments in the last few issues. And I want to say one of my favorite parts about the last issue is the scene with Catman and Deadshot. They're just kind of talking to each other, and the whole series they've been written as like they're teammates, but they kind of hate each other. But then this one character pretty much outs them as being like, yeah, you pretty much do like each other as friends. Like, can't you just admit it? Like it's a really great moment because they've always been written as like, man, just kind of like whatever. Like, I hate that guy, but it's always been implied that they're actually pretty good friends, and it's a great moment to have them like outed as being like, yeah, they're almost brothers in a way.
Wow, Secret Six, read that stuff. That's great. Yeah. We're gonna finish off Black Thought by Spectacular Spider-Man the TV show. I've watched season one. I'm three discs into season two. I'm gonna start the last disc probably tomorrow. The show, you're watching it, it's kind of like when we were talking about Captain America, the moment where Peggy's talking to Steve before he's like, we're going to have a date next week, right before hitting the water, and you all know that she's going to be old and or dead. And I'm feeling that way about Spectacular Spider-Man. It's like, I don't want this to end. It makes me so sad. And I'm trying not to let it like already establish my ideas of Ultimate Spider-Man, because I'm gonna watch it. I mean, boom! It's gonna be good, hopefully. But Spectacular Spider-Man is some really, really special superhero TV. I just finished with the Valentine Day episode. Do you guys know which one that is? The one with the opera music playing?
No, I didn't get to see that one.
It's Valentine's Day, of course, and Peter and everyone's out there, and they're doing their thing, and Peter gets called off because of the two gang lords, and of course, Dr. Octopus. Are all three fighting over control of New York, and this fight scene, it takes up most of the episode, has opera music playing over it, so it's kind of like it's like dance moves to this opera, and it's just, it was so cool. Probably my favorite episode of the show. I just finished that. I know it's probably discouraging because the show doesn't exist anymore, and it's, of course, Ultimate Spider-Man is going to be early next year. I strongly, strongly recommend everyone pick up season one of The Spectacular Spider-Man, and then, by any means possible, get the final four or five discs. They'll be considered volumes. I think it's volume 5 through 8. Hop in on that, guys. Please watch it. It's so good. It's one of my favorite animated shows ever. I love it. It's not Batman the Animated Series, but the way they write Peter, the actor who portrays Peter Parker Spider-Man, and his time, the comedic timing is professional, and it's the most fun I have watching the Spider-Man cartoons. It's the best one. It's really, really good. So I don't know if you guys have anything to add to that in my hyperbole fest, but I love it so much.
Basically, just agreed. And I think that the guy who does the voice of Spider-Man, Josh something or other, can't remember.
Josh Keaton.
Josh Keaton. He's going to be doing Spider-Man's voice in, I think, the upcoming Spider-Man video game. Or maybe
really?
The last one that came out. I can't remember.
Oh, no. But that last Shattered Dimensions is bad.
It might be the one that's coming up.
He was
he was in that one. He was in that game, but... I think he is doing a voice on a new one as well.
And that, I think Shattered Dimensions also had the guy who did Peter Parker for the 90s show. He was Spider-Man Noir.
Yeah, he was Spider-Man Noir. The Spider-Man from the old Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends was the Spider-Man of the future. What was it? 2099?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And and of course the ultimate Spider-Man in that game was portrayed by I forgot his name again. Not Michael Keaton.
That'd be awesome. I'd buy
that. Portrayed by Josh Keaton.
Josh Keaton was Ultimate Spider-Man, and so you got your witty, awesome, Spectacular Spider-Man humor, just not as well written. it's good. The problem is that game drags on. Like, it was like I was loving it for the first 7-ish missions, and then by the 8th, I'm kind of like, it's just dragged on. And Edge of Time, I think, will be the same.
It didn't help that the noir levels were the best part of the game.
Yeah.
And then that was one, so 1/4 of it's really good, and then the rest of it's basically the same game.
Yep. Oh, and Neil Patrick Harris was amazing Spider-Man. There were 4 Spider-Mans in that game.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yep, and all 4 of them have played Spider-Man at one time. Neil Patrick Harris was the MTV Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you who do not know. All right. Guys, that is, we're going to put a wrap to what you bought, what you thought. There are a lot of great books out there, so go and buying. And we're going to get into a little bit more of our commentary section right now. We're going to rev it up with, what are your favorite X-Mens? We're going to be talking about everyone's 2 favorite X-Men comics. And then we're going to kind of touch to it at the end and kind of like, as a group, discuss the X-Men comics that stink like a rotten toilet seat. But we want to be positive. We're glass half full people here on Spoiler Alert. So we're going to start with everyone's favorite X-Men stories. And Brandon, we're going to let you go first because you are on the left of my Skype screen. So.
All right. I was thinking about it, and originally I was going to say House of M and Magneto Testament. Uh-huh. I decided to change House of M to a different... It's not really a particular story, but it's a series that was, in my opinion, was pretty underrated. Was Exiles, and I think it's like one of my favorite X-Men like series, just because it's a combination of X-Men and Sliders, which is probably like the coolest thing ever. And it's really amazing because it takes a whole bunch of X-Men from all the different parallel universes and puts them together on a team that has to solve a particular like problem, or they have to figure out what's wrong with a world, and then they have to fix it, and then they move on to the next one. Eventually, they'll find their way home. But it's a really amazing series because the lineup changes frequently, and like they introduce something new in about like the 6th volume. It was pretty interesting is that like they'll never actually find their way home in a sense, but. Just the characters are so well written, and for a while it was by Judd Winnick, he handled it pretty well, I think. And the character of Morph is just so amazing because what happens to him is heartbreaking, and just mm-hmm. so well thought out, and just horrifying all of this at the same time. That I really hope everyone takes a chance on that series.
Actually, to put someone in that is I got on the Exiles train late. I actually got into it when Tody and Bedard started writing it, when they went to their world tour, and that's basically what happened to Morph was screwed up. Like if you really think about what it is, it's pretty far. I mean, Exiles is so good of a concept, you figure nobody can screw it up, because even Chuck Austin, as he was ruining the Uncanny X-Men. He even wrote some good issues of Exiles when he stepped in for like 2 issues. Like, he wrote good extra. Like, it was one of those things. Like, it's such an easy concept. It's basically doing what ifs, but in continuity. And then Claremont got the hold to it. But that's all I wanted to say, because I wanted to chime in on that, because I hadn't even thought about the book Exiles in so long.
What was really great about that book? Was how well it was paced, which was kind of surprising, because you know your standard what if comic is kind of okay. You get this setup of here's this world where Batman's a ballerina and whatever else is messed up in this world, and now you have to solve the problem. But like, you had these arcs of different lengths. You had some that were lighthearted, some that were really serious. You had, I think that book was better paced than most other X-Men comics coming out at the time, which is just kind of surprising for a book that is basically playing on what used to be a one and done format.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you brought that up. It's a great book.
I really like it a lot. Yeah.
Fantastic. Great. Anything else you want to add, Brandon?
I was just thinking about it. I haven't read it in like, I think I read pretty much almost through the whole thing in about a few days, because it was me and my brother. It was at like 4 years ago. Our house burned down, and before that, we went to the library and we put in requests for these books up to I think volume 13. And what happened was all the books came in the week after like that happened. So that's all we did for about a week straight is just read Exiles, and it was so as Mark said, it's so well paced that it was just so like fascinating. Just go from like one to the next one, you just kept going with them. It was awesome.
Wonderful, thank you, Brandon. That was terrific. Crane, you want to knock yours out?
Oh sure. See, now you brought in a series. I feel like I'm gonna throw one at the end because I'm gonna throw out two. I won't go into detail about it, but my stories that I'm gonna recommend actually are, you go with an old one. God Loves, Man Kills, which is a classic story. One of the best uses of X-Men as an allegory for minorities there is. Period. And the other one I actually will say is, I was going between a bunch of like classics, you know, generic. I could have said Days of Future Past. I've never actually read that one, but I have read Inferno and Mutant Massacre, and back when I was younger, Execution Strong was song was really strong. But what I'm gonna go with actually is a more recent story, which I thought was a really good crossover, The Dark Avengers, Dark X-Men.
Oh,
I really like. It's an odd choice, especially when, you know, with the ones I threw out were classics, but I figure it's more interesting just because it's a more recent example, and it's probably one of the best signs of Cyclops as the leader that they've had so far. It came from, you know, the directive for Dark Reign, which really reinvigorated about all the Marvel Universe. Like honestly, in the past few years, one of the best creatively. It seemed like one of the best times the writers I've had is just working with that Dark Reign over the heads. But it's Dark X-Men with this evil version of X-Men going against the X-Men in San Francisco, and just how Cyclops maneuvers everything around. It's somebody who's not a big Cyclops fan. I appreciate him. He's a all right leader, but always been kind of milquetoast for me. But reading that story along with some stuff that like Whedon had done and some of the appearance, some stuff that Morrison had done, people had done in later years. Like that story especially showed that Cyclops is not somebody he should be messed with. This is the man who's going to lead the X-Men, and I'm a big fan of it. But other than that, you know, you have your classics, the Mutant Massacre, Inferno, Execution Song, but that's been talked about ad nauseum by 1,000 people, so I'm not going to go there. But I'm not going to go into detail, but there's two things come from around the same time that I think should be read, since Brandon's going to go and bring it up. Around the same time with Exiles, actually, Weapon X and X-Statics. It was during a time where my favorite X books were not even the ones that had X-Men in the title. Weapon X made me a fan of Frank Terry, and I haven't read anybody write Sabretooth as well as Frank Terry has and continues to. And that book, Weapon X 5 is one of the most heartbreaking books I've ever read, in general. Like there's some pretty heavy ones out there, but it makes you care about Maggot, which I didn't think was possible. It's a very great run. I will admit it peters out at the end because Frank tries to bring in more attention on the stories, so he starts throwing in a lot more Wolverine. When early on you barely see Wolverine at all, he starts trying to bring in Wolverine and focuses more on Sabretooth and some other things to try to bring in more attention because a lot of the books were struggling for readers at the time. So I'm not a fan of that, nor am I a fan of the follow up Days of Future Present. Weapon X needed more than 5 issues to finish up, and Terry had all these ideas he just crammed into 5 issues, and it doesn't work out so well. So like it doesn't end on the best note, but it's the reality of the situation what killed it. And X-Statics, that's Allred's art, and it's just it's great. And that Milligan's weird his take on pop cultures on pop superheroes. Especially the commentary on how disposable pop superstars and reality stars are by literally killing them off. I mean, most of the team dies in the first issue. It's a really funny book. It brought us Dupe, which I'm forever thankful for. So those are two series I think everybody, if you haven't read it, I think X-Statics is getting a complete, getting a hardcover sometime soon, next few months. You should definitely pick that one up if you can. And Weapon X is hard to get in pieces. I mean, I got those when they came out, but it's it wasn't a very popular book, so its reprints don't happen very often. But if you can find it somewhere, please do. And, oh yeah, to go back to God Loves, Man Kills, excellent freaking story. So that's all my stuff in a nutshell.
Fantastic, Dan. Thank you.
Weapon X is a great series, and I think even better than that is the Wolverine run that Thierry did that led into that, which is the best Wolverine story that I've ever read. And I've read a lot of Wolverine stories, and that is by far my favorite one. And it's a shame that has not been properly collected in a trade, and that Weapon X has not been properly collected. Hopefully Marvel will fix that at some point. Yeah. But those are two fantastic runs. And even that little like kind of crossover into Deadpool that happened that Thierry did.
Oh yeah,
with that Wolverine run. That was great. Yeah, yeah. That was, I think, the best Deadpool story I've ever read.
All right.
I just love Frank Thierry. I can't. I anything that man comes out with, I make sure to put him on my pull list. He has a Hercules. That may have ended because he had a Hercules and Wolverine book.
Myths and like mutants, myths and monsters, or something like that. The trade's coming out.
He has an understanding of Wolverine that most writers wish they had. Like because he doesn't write him as a nice guy. He writes Wolverine as he does good things, but he's kind of a dick, and, and he just is. And he's a good heart. He's a good hearted dick.
The thing is, he also writes him as a smart person, which a lot of people don't get. They just kind of write him as this brute. I mean, Thierry's run ended, and then they went into the Greg Rucka thing, and basically he was just like a mindless killer. And after like reading that great Thierry run, I was really disappointed in that. I felt like such a regression, because here you had I loved how they had like the ongoing internal monologue throughout the Thierry run, and I didn't feel like we got anything that good in that vein until Jason Aaron came on, and that was like 5 years later.
Now, Mark, what are your two favorite X-Men stories?
Well, my two...
Or the two favorites. You want to talk about.
those are two different things. Like, my two favorites are New X-Men and Astonishing X-Men are my two favorites. But everybody pretty much knows those, and we can get into those.
Oh, I'm going to talk about Astonishing, so don't worry.
Yeah, I figured we'd get into those in a minute. So the ones I was going to talk about instead... the first one is Chris Claremont and Jim Lee's X-Men number one. It's one issue. This was one of the first comic books that I ever had. Basically, just that is the essence of the X-Men in that book. If you just read that comic, if you don't like it, then you can just basically write off the 80s and the 90s, or the late 80s and the 90s of X-Men. Just don't bother. If you don't like that issue, you probably won't like anything else. But if you do like it, more power to you, I guess. But that's the issue where you get those kind of iconic costumes of the X-Men that everybody knows, that were in the TV show, that I think are still like the most easily identifiable costumes that the X-Men have ever had. And it's to be quite honest, not the greatest story itself, but it's a lot of fun. It's just, I'm sure you guys have read it. Dan, you've read it.
Yeah.
Right?
But yeah, X-Men, the early X-Men stuff is iconic.
So the other one I wanted to talk about was one that probably would not come to most people's minds, and it's a crossover.
Onslaught?
No. Negative. It's a crossover that came out about 2 years before that, actually, called the Phalanx Covenant. And this was the first, like, crossover that I ever read. And I loved it at the time. And I thought, I didn't really want to go back to it for a long time, because I figured it's one of those things that, you know, you like when you're first getting into comics. But I actually read it again a couple months ago, and it's really pretty good. What's interesting about it is that it's like a crossover, but it's three mini crossovers all like rolled into one. There's like the main part of it is basically Banshee and Emma Frost go and rescue some kids who have been like captured by this like techno-organic alien race, and those kids end up forming the team Generation X, which was, in my opinion, the best superhero series of the 1990s. And so that kind of sets up that series. That is the best part of the crossover. We've already mentioned Crossed, so this is already an explicit rated podcast, so I don't have any problem saying now.
No, go ahead.
Banshee kicks ass. Banshee kicks so much ass in this comic. This is the comic that made me just love that character. And we even have Sabretooth in here, and I normally hate Sabretooth. Other than the Phalanx Covenant and Weapon X, I hate Sabretooth. So it's a testament to any story when it can make me like Sabretooth. And then so the other like two parts of this mini, like the other two mini crossovers of this larger event, they're not as good, but they're still, one of them's decent. The other one is kind of eh. It has Wolverine and Cable, and they're just kind of blowing stuff up, and that's not so interesting. But we have like art by Chris Bachalo and Joe Matarira and Andy Kubert, like kind of all those icons of the 90s. It's just quintessential 90s X-Men done right, unlike most 90s X-Men.
Well, we talked a little bit about stereotyping earlier, but this is a completely different type. 90s X-Men get stereotyped a lot, just like 90s Spider-Man. So, I mean, sounds like 90s X-Men isn't as all-around bad. I mean, there's probably bad all around it, but the...
Yeah, it's pretty much surrounded by awfulness, but there are islands of goodness in the 90s.
Very, very cool.
You just know where to look.
All right. I guess I'll close this off, guys. I'm going to talk about just one, because I'm probably going to go ad nauseum about it. Josh Wheaton and John Cassidy's Astonishing X-Men is my favorite comic of all time. The 24 issue, is it 24 issues in the one giant size?
Yes.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, for example, when you think of it, the book has so much against it for the scheduling. Of course, the scheduling doesn't matter at this point. You can go and get the trades, the hardcovers, or I think the omnibus is still in print. But at the time there was delays, on top of the fact that the villains aren't necessarily like superb. Danger isn't like a tremendous villain. It's mostly just kind of watching all of these characters come together. Kitty Pryde, of course, is I would probably say the main character of this arc. She's the one who you'll sympathize with the most. But when it came to me personally and what makes Astonishing X-Men so special, it is how Wheaton treated the team and how Cyclops worked with the team. Cyclops has been my favorite X-Man since forever, all right? And the way that he wrote the story, I think of the part where the broken-down Sentinel is heading toward the X-Manor, and Wolverine, I think it's Wolverine, Colossus, and Cyclops are kind of doing their thing. I was wondering if it was Beast or Colossus, but it's Colossus. And Cyclops says, "I'm going to get this off my yard." And he takes off his visor, and he looks out, and this whole panel goes red. And he puts it back on, and Wolverine says, "This is why you're the leader of the team." It's just the moments like that, for wrestling fans out there, the mark moment, the part where you just kind of stand up and just cheer because of how exciting it is. John Cassidy is my favorite artist ever. And these books, like, look at the covers. Like, when you think of, like, the best covers in the series, even the ones as simple as Wolverine lunging at you or his hand up with the blades coming out, I feel every cover is beautiful. And then, of course, there's the two best covers probably from that series. And I'd be curious to see what you guys would think of this. One is the absolutely jaw-dropping Shadow Cat. Kitty Pryde and Colossus cover, where she's phasing through him. Mm-hmm. The other one is where Emma is covering Scott's eyes.
Was that a variant, or was that a normal cover?
I believe that was the normal cover. Yeah,
that was normal. Yeah. Okay.
And so you look at this, and you're immediately like, your eyes kind of are caught by what the giant size cover, which is your kind of basic iconic team going after a threat cover, but it's just, I think it's so good. But you, I mean, you see this, your eye catches the covers, you pick it up, the art on the inside looks just as good as the cover on the front. Wheaton understood these characters, he wrote them all brilliantly. You rooted for them, it was just from start to finish. And when you look at Cyclops and how Wheaton, I believe Wheaton's logic was the fact that you had to strip down Cyclops to his core values, in this case taking away his powers, which he had had for almost his entire life, and seeing that in reality Scott Summers' powers wasn't Jean Grey who held him back, or it wasn't Charles Xavier who, and I would also argue, holds Scott Summers back. It was that leadership quality is the true power that he had, the true superhuman strength he had, and it's just the way that where even when she was like holding him back, like removing the powers and for the benefit of the Hellfire Club, you saw Scott Summers' best powers come out, and it's his leadership. I mean, I think everyone remembers late in the series, you see the scene right before Cyclops, quote-unquote, dies, and then the beginning of the next issue, you see them all, like, talking in Emma's brain, and you just, building up to, of course, where that issue ends with the Come to Me, My X-Men, and I adore every single page of Astonishing X-Men by Josh Wheaton and John Cassidy. Now, Warren Ellis took over afterwards, and I didn't keep reading after that, but when people talk about not just like X-Men stories that are the greatest of all time, like comic stories, I look forward to giving once my kids are older, my future children, the experience of Josh Wheaton and John Cassidy's Astonishing X-Men. Because it is so special to me, and I think it's so special when you look at like the history of the X-Men and what that story means for those characters. Comments, complaints. I just splurged all over it. I love it so much.
I like the Astonishing X-Men.
Everyone goes from speechless to talking over each other. This is fantastic. What do you guys think? Brandon.
I think Whedon has, he has one of my favorite scenes with Spider-Man is near the end when he's having his dream about how he saves the world is that he makes a giant spider web and catches the bullet, and he's just cheering because he's so excited. He's like, wait, what? It's just like, even the audience is thinking like that's so improbable and just so ridiculous that even Spider-Man realizes that, yeah, that's pretty dumb. And then I love how Spider-Man, through the power of daydreaming, he saves, like, he lets the X-Men know that, like, something bad's gonna happen. And one of my other favorite scenes is when they're fighting the monster in the second volume. It's the first issue when they're fighting in one of the monsters at Fantastic Four.
One of the Ball Man's monsters, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I love Colossus. He's, like, hanging on to him. And he has the inner monologue about how what he feels about Kitty, and his feelings are really complicated at this point. And then one of my favorite lines is that he's like, I'm hanging on to a monster's nostril, so I should probably concentrate. And then Kitty has this pretty much the same thoughts about Colossus. She's really confused, and she's like, I should probably concentrate. And then the best is with Logan. He's just slashing away at the monster, and he's like, I like beer. That's one of my favorite inner monologue scenes of any comic.
Beast, when Beast loses his mind and he rebuilds it a scent oriented ball of string, and so by unraveling the string it like restores his brain, like it kind of like brings him back to where he was. I know we were talking about dumbing down Wolverine. I don't necessarily think that Wheaton did that, but that the Wolverine, of course, has been dropped down to this terrified man, and he's climbing a tree.
I think he made light of that take on him that reduces him to, like, just a raw, violent brute.
Mm-hmm. And, and the beer falls in front of him, and he holds it up, and it's a three-panel situation. The beer falls on him, he holds it up, he's out of focus, the beer's in focus, and then you see the transition where the beer goes out of focus and his eyes are in focus, and you can see a complete change of character. That right there is a testament to Cassidy's skills as an artist, which just are endless in my opinion. I mean, then you think about the way that it ends and like the, just how heartbreaking it is, and like this great moment of this heroic moment for Kitty, and it's just it's so well done. And again, with Cassidy's skills, Cassidy knows how to draw a web slinging Spider-Man. That first page you see Spider-Man web slinging, it was beautiful, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Crane, well, anything you want to add?
No, you've gone over it enough. I mean, it's a very strong book. I mean, I think the danger part is not as strong as the rest at all, really. But it's I think it's a very good. Those first six issues are as good as X-Men get, really. It's a very strong story. But I mean, for Gifted itself, the first six issues are probably, that's probably as good as you'll get in a X-Men book when it comes to just the character relations. But it's I do have a question for you though, Blake.
Sure.
So I know you said this is your favorite X-Men book and you don't have a lot of history. So have you read any of the Claremont and Byrne stuff?
No, I'm very X-Men illiterate. I'm very, very X-Men illiterate. I read Astonishing, and then I picked up New X-Men, and I was like, okay, let's New X-Men. I love Grant Morrison, and New X-Men just didn't. It felt so small when compared. Like literally Schism is the first really like the first X-Men story I've really enjoyed since Astonishing. I think I've built up Astonishing so much in my mind that it's very hard.
That's interesting because, like, to me, Astonishing is kind of like New X-Men's little brother. It's like
it's a lot smaller book than New X-Men was.
Yeah, honestly. I mean, in terms of volume, in terms of scope, in terms of actual page number, it's smaller. But in terms of cast of characters it's working with, it's smaller. Which isn't to say that any of those things are bad. I just think that there's more scope and more breadth to what Morrison did. And I feel like what he did was more ambitious and more revolutionary in terms of superhero storytelling at that time. And I think Whedon just told a really, really good X-Men story.
Whedon was a very safe story. I mean, you look at what Morrison did in that book. He killed Jean Grey. He had Scott Summers cheat on Jean Grey with Emma Frost. He killed Magneto. Destroyed Jacinto.
It wasn't even just in terms of plot points of what happened. I mean, he dressed him up in leather. He played with the entire format.
He outed them.
Superhero comics. Yeah,
that's the thing. Like that's the biggest thing he did there. I mean, early on he outed the X-Men. Like that was a big moment. Because they had always lived in secret for what they had the secret identities, which I thought by outing them was like, finally, you can't really, like, it doesn't make sense for the X-Men to be a secret identity. They need to be they need to be true to who they are in all regards. So that was the biggest thing. But I do recommend, I mean, if you can get over, like, Claremont's old, the book's from the 70s and 80s. So if you can get over that style of writing, like this, if you especially with liking Cyclops the way you do, I definitely recommend going back to some of the Claremont Byrne stuff. I mean, that's where basically the Cyclops that Whedon was writing came from. That's where they got the character from. He was a capable leader in the original stories. I didn't know that till I went back to him. But it was the 90s. It wasn't until the 90s until Wolverine became the center point. It was late 80s, I guess, but hell, if you look at the original Secret War, Wolverine gets his ass handed to him pretty quickly in there. Like, it's Cyclops is the one that they're behind. I wouldn't say minor, but he's not like, you write Secret Wars today, Wolverine is one of the top four characters you're going to see running things, but not then. Like, he was, like, of the X-Men, he wasn't even one of the top one of them dealing with the problems.
Do you guys agree with the sentiment I have that Cyclops is held back by Jean Grey and Professor Xavier?
I don't think he's held back by them as much as writers are. Yeah. Bad writers are more tied into his relationship with them. Like, they feel like it has to be led by Professor X, and they feel that Cyclops has to be doting on Jean Grey. By not having Professor X involved and having Jean Grey dead, he's liberated. It's the same thing that's going on with Rogue. where forever she was limited by Richard Gere over there with Gambit, and she was limited by him, and it wasn't until writers started saying, "Hey, we just divorce her from him, we can do something interesting with the character," and then a lot better things were happening because it's just bad writers. We're just too dependent on that side of the character, which is the love interest and the Wolverine, Jean Grey crap and all that. And it's just, yeah. That's why, to a degree, I agree with you, but I don't think it's inherently his problem. I think it's a problem with writers not knowing how to write him.
Yeah, if you look at, there have been some really good stories that people have managed to tell with Cyclops, but they're really few and far between. But when they're good, they're really good, I think. There was that, like, Cyclops Retribution, which was that, like, Marvel Comics Presents storyline, in the early 90s. That was decent. The Brian K. Vaughan miniseries was fantastic. Sadly, has not been collected yet. Maybe it will be someday. And then there was this, like, one issue, and I think it was, like, close to Uncanny X-Men number 400. It was a little bit before that. And it was by Scott Lobdell, and it was just about Cyclops and his relationship with his dad. And that was the whole issue. And that was like a really good kind of done in one issue. And like you said, the whole astonishing, his whole portrayal throughout that. So when they try, I think they do, when they zero in on what makes that character tick, they can do a really good job with it.
Wonderful. Okay, one more thing before I guess we'll touch on bad, but we're kind of going long, so we'll probably start toning it down. If you guys are like, man, I feel like watching X-Men 3, X-Men United, just kind of open up and read the first arc of Astonishing X-Men, because that deals with a cure, and that is an infinitely better story.
that it is.
Yeah.
So I guess speaking of X-Men 3, we can talk a little bit about the poop. When it comes to X-Men, any, like, one story. We'll go with one story. I'll kind of bow out of this part. But you three guys, name, like, your least favorite X-Men story, the one you think is just the absolute worst. And you can't say Onslaught, because that is universally hated. And we'll just leave it away. Yep, no Onslaught.
It's the only one I know.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go with one that I actually finished. I couldn't even finish Onslaught. And I couldn't finish the Draco, which probably would have...
Oh.
Which probably would have won this dubious honor if I had been able to get past the halfway point, because that is just a miserable, miserable story. It's basically this story where Nightcrawler finds out that, like, Mystique is his mom and his dad is a demon, and it is just the dumbest thing that I have ever not finished reading. But the dumbest thing that I have finished reading is by the same writer, Chuck Austin, and it was either the arc right before that or right afterwards, and it was called Dominant Species.
It was before that.
It was the one right before that? Yeah. Okay.
I don't know, it was right before. It was a little before that anyway. Yeah, okay. But it's set up for that, yeah.
But that was terrible. That one features Warren Worthington as a pedophile, which is great to read.
That's a not...
Yeah, there's this subplot where he, like, falls in love with Husk, who is like 15 years old and a member of Generation X.
Well, no, she's 18, but it's...
Oh, is she?
Well, yeah, she has to be.
Oh, one of those Japanese 18s. Like, where you...
The thing was, the way she was drawn, she looked like she was like 12, because...
Well, see, Japanese 18.
It's kind of like Pixie, where her age jumped up because it had to.
Yeah, because it had to for it to be legal.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And there's just this horrifying scene when the thing is over, when, like, Angel grabs her and they, like, fly up into the air, and, like, all the X-Men are down, like, looking up, watching them, and her mom is down there watching them, and then, like, you just see, like, their clothes fall back down to Earth.
Oh, my God.
And it's like, her mom is watching, and everyone is watching.
Well, and, maybe for him, it's like, it's kinda hot.
Chuck Austin, just say no.
Wonderful.
Say no to Chuck Austin's Uncanny X-Men.
You know, I was thinking, though, what we should do is a special edition of Spoiler Alert, where we should read it aloud on the podcast, like everyone takes a character.
Cool. Dramatic reading, that would be hilarious. Oh my goodness, dramatic reading crappy comics, that would be fantastic. Dan, you're going last. Brandon, what is the X-Men story of that you're gonna throw in the old toilet bowl?
I really don't know. I actually haven't read too much X-Men to really hate on any of it, but there's a few Ultimate X-Men ones that near the end it started, you could tell it was like, this is getting pretty bad. It was some guy, he wrote Heroes for a while, so you know, that was a sign like things are not gonna be good. And he wrote some story about Colossus was trying to up his strength or something. It was just stupid. I can't even remember.
Banshee?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, where they take Banshee, which is basically mutant growth hormone, and so Colossus like Nightcrawler becomes like an ultra demon thing looking thing. Angel basically starts looking like a bird. It's some weird. That was not a good part of Ultra X-Men. Once Kirkman left, Kirkman kept the thing okay, but when he left, it got really, really bad.
Was Kirkman before or after Bendis?
He was after.
Yeah. Because I thought Bendis's run was bad. I guess it wasn't actively bad so much as that, like, it was Bendis decompression at its absolute worst. I think I think Colossus had like two lines over the course of his 12 issues. He just clearly had no idea what he wanted to do with him.
I can't even remember his run that well, actually. I read it, but
because nothing really happened. I think Wolverine got like attacked by some assassin lady, and then they went to the Capitol building, and it collapsed, and like the Beast died, and that was it.
Oh yeah, that was pretty.
Spoilers.
Cool. That's fine. That's what we're here for.
It's sad because he had a very strong issue with I forgot which issue it was, but this kid had powers that killed like his mutant.
Oh yeah,
good. Kill people around them, like so people would just combust and just turn to dust just from being around. And when he realized it was like he basically killed his parents, his town, his school. Everybody was dead. So he went and hid in a cave. And Wolverine came to him because you know with his powers he wouldn't die from this thing combusting him, and he ends up killing the kid, you know, to put him out of his misery basically when they track him down. But it's like the. To tell you that way, it sounds a lot worse than it is. I mean, it is a very strong issue, like how it all plays out. And I mean, the only problem, I think David Finch drew it, so the emotion on Wolverine when he comes out of the cave isn't as strong as it should be, but it's still a very good. It's a very good issue there, but like, I didn't really care for a lot of what he did.
Yeah, you're
I was
right. going to
mention that one.
Issue.
I really liked him a lot.
All right. Crane, go ahead. I'm expecting this to be the most entertaining one. Your least favorite X-Men story?
Mine would be Apocalypse of the 12. If you don't remember this, well, you probably wouldn't. Why would
don't
you?
Even want to hear about it.
They were hinting for about a decade, the 12. Like, these 12 people who would eventually kill Apocalypse. And they've been hinting at the mutants that would be involved with it. And their powers would come together and it would be the method they need. And, the problem, though, these 12, is that they towards the end when they finally did the storyline, they didn't match. Like they flat out went totally against what the storyline was. Like the characters they mentioned before would have been part of the 12. They wouldn't change it to this weird thing where you know they had to have Magneto and Polaris because they had different poles of magnetism. Storm, Firestorm. X-Men was there. X-Men was there. Iceman, I can't remember all 12 of them because it doesn't matter. Either way, basically, because Magneto was weakened by something else, it failed, and so Apocalypse was going to use the 12 to become more powerful. Like it's basically ascend to near godhood, essentially. And the way the story ended is essentially, Cyclops died, and then they went on going on the search for Cyclops. Apocalypse. Let me not skip things here. Apocalypse, his soul left his body and it needed a new one, so he jumped into Cyclops' body. And to kill Apocalypse, Cable used this big. He ended up using this spear, and the spear was the thing that you had to use because it can kill the soul or whatever. So he ended up killing Cyclops, and then Cyclops died. So Cyclops did. That's why for a while you'll see Cable wearing. If you look at pictures, you'll see him like with Cyclops's visor hanging from his neck or wearing a mask that covers just one of his eyes. He was doing that in honor of his father like that. And then they did the hunt for Cyclops where they had to go find his body, and then his soul was, it was,
wow.
This happened a little before I got back into comics, and this was before I got back into it, but I was paying attention because it was on IGN comics, I believe, early on IGN comics. That's basically when I, around the time I joined IGN. So it was early IGN comics when they were a part of the sci-fi site. So I don't know. I kept looking in and seeing the covers of this thing, but it's confusing because I'm sure it makes more sense if you read a storyline synopsis. But there's no point. It's not good. I've read a few issues of it, and it's not written well. It's one of the reasons why I don't know if Lobdell wrote it, but I'm not looking forward to Lobdell and DCNU, the new universe. Anything like Lobdell was responsible for a lot of really bad books, but one good thing from that time was Joe Casey writing Uncanny X-Men there's always a bright spot even when that shit's going on. You have Joe Casey writing a very neat idea where Warren Worthington fights supervillains with his money.
It was Joseph Harris who wrote Search for Cyclops.
So who wrote Apocalypse 12?
I forget. It was like Terry Cavanaugh. I think it was like a few people like wrote it together. It was one of those things that I think this was at the point where even like Alan Davis was kind of there, like not in an art capacity, but he was just like kind of writing stuff for cash. Lobdell was involved.
Cavanaugh, yeah. Joe Pruitt, Alan Davis, Chris Claremont. Oh yeah, this was after Claremont came back to the X-Men.
No, this was right when Claremont came back. This was what brought Claremont back.
Okay, so because that's what, and after this will probably bring you to the Neo and all those other junk that he was
right.
doing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I remember this very well because this is when I like started like really hardcore collecting comics. Was like the lead up to the X-Men movie was what got me interested. So I think one of the first issues I bought was Search for Cyclops number 3. Like I never read the first two issues.
This also brought us a time when Wolverine had died, but they figured out it was actually a mutant Skrull that looked like Wolverine.
Yeah, well, that was a little bit before. That was maybe like, like 2 years before, I think.
Yeah, but Wolverine was still dead until you got to that. He came back with Apocalypse's death.
Yeah.
I remember that much. Exactly. Yeah, that was
just a bad time. The thing was, I thought like the Claremont stuff was great at the time because I had, you know, just started buying comics and I was like, wow, this is cool. The art was cool. I thought the stories were good. And it's funny because like a year later is when they started is when Grant Morrison started New X-Men, and like the first mm-hmm. issue of that I got it and I was just like, what? Like this isn't what the X-Men are supposed to be like. Like they're supposed to be like fighting the Neo and all this and like all these stupid crappy villains that Claremont had them fighting. So I do have to thank Grant Morrison for that, for fixing my view of comics.
Wonderful. Thank you, Grant Morrison. There we go. I guess that's the theme of Spoiler Alert. It's just one big thank you to Grant Morrison.
Yeah.
All right, guys. That's it for this week's Spoiler Alert. I think we had a lot of fun. Let's give a golf clap to Dan Pratt, who was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I'm golf clapping. You cannot hear it because it's a golf clap. Thank you so much. Anything you want to say to the audience?
Don't be bitches.
That's,
I don't know.
Well, there we go.
That.
Wonderful.
Before we go, we should also plug our blog.
Yes.
Plug www.spoileralertpod.blogspot.com. And if you have comments, questions, anything of that nature, you can send us an email at spoileralertpod@gmail.com. And if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, it is spoileralertpod again. So,
there we go. Yeah. Fantastic. Thank you, Mark. We've plugged that sucker away. All right. For Brandon Hyde, Mark Diefendurfer, Daniel Pratt, I'm Blake Kelly. This is Spoiler Alert. You guys stay smoking, and I guess for House of M,